Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. This is the first Sunday afternoon talk that I've done for about 15 years. So I remember way back when I lived here in the late 80s and early 90s. I would fill in for Lumpho Sumedho occasionally, and so I'm very glad to be back during this time, and also these few months of overlapping as he's getting ready to depart, and I'm just slowly arriving. So the theme for the afternoon's talk is where is the Dhamma, and I think most of you will realize the answer to that question is it's in the temple rather than the sala this week. Those of you who haven't realized that, please leave the sala now and come over here. So this is an interesting theme. It has many dimensions. I've been pondering what would be the best way to approach this. And what occurred to me was, first of all, was to, in a way to look at, first of all, rather than where is the Dhamma, but to start off with, what is the Dhamma? When we use the word Dhamma or the Sanskrit form Dharma, what is it that we mean? What's that referring to? Yeah. When we take the three, what's called the three refuges, when the basic commitment to the Buddhist path and the way of Buddhist practice, we pay respects to or affirm our commitment to what the three refuges, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And so that's usually represented as the Buddha, as Gautama Buddha, the teacher who lived 2,500 years ago, the Dhamma as the Buddha's teaching and the words that he gave, and then the Sangha, the third refuge, is the community of those who have awakened to the truth, have realized the nature of reality to a certain level of realization, a certain depth of stream entry, or different levels of enlightenment that the Buddha talked about. So that's the classical description of the three refuges. And oftentimes when we talk about Dhamma or Dhamma teachings, Buddha Dhamma, the assumption that the mind makes is naturally towards the words of the Buddha. These are the usual form that we think of that as referring to. So we think of all of the books in the library that are referring to Buddha's teachings, or all of the scriptures from the Pali Canon, the Theravada scriptures of the Southern Buddhist world, or the sutras of the Northern Buddhist world. But one of the most important things to recognize or to reflect on in this area is that the verbal side of the teachings, or the verbal Dhamma, is only one small part of it, or one dimension of what is meant by the word Dhamma. Certainly the Buddha spoke a lot. For 45 years he gave the Dhamma teachings, and there's volumes and volumes of scriptures that were recorded, memorized by the Venerable Ananda initially, and then carried on through and memorized and passed on through the ages. But and then when we study the teachings, then we are extremely grateful to have all of those verbal resources, and the Buddha's brilliance at putting things into words is is, I would say, in my biased opinion, is unsurpassed in pointing out the way to arrive at a quality of freedom and peace. So it's very easy, very natural for us to then lock our attention onto those words, the many volumes of the Pali Canon or the Mahayana Sutras or the many, many commentaries, endless numbers of books that have been written about Buddhist teachings over the centuries, and that volumes and volumes just in our own library, let alone on in the libraries of London or Amazon, the bookstore, the endless variety of teachings available. So it's completely natural and ordinary for us to lock our attention onto the words. But one of the emphases that our teacher Ajahn Chah used to make in terms of studying Dhamma and committing oneself to using the Buddha's teachings, he said that these are teachings to be applied, that the value of the word of the Buddha is not in just collecting the words, it's not just in memorizing them or just in the rejoicing in the brilliance of them or the clarity of those explanations, but the usefulness, the real value, is in how they can help us, the changes they can bring about within us. And particularly because he was teaching in the context of Thailand, where when he was a young monk, back in the earlier part of the middle part of the 20th century, in Thailand it was actually quite rare for monastics to meditate, and extremely rare for any lay people to meditate at all. It was sort of considered to be not the done thing, or that it was some kind of belief that if you meditated you'd go crazy, or you'd only practice meditation if you were interested in developing black magic. And somehow or other these strange beliefs had grown up that it was dangerous to meditate, you were going to go crazy or cause yourself endless trouble. So the best thing to do was to study the teachings, make lots of merit, and hope you're going to be reborn in the time of Maitreya Buddha, some undefined point in the future, when the next Buddha comes along. Make lots of merit and then make sure you get reborn when the next Buddha comes along. And when people would come to Ajahn Chah and would ask him about that, or they would express that particular opinion, he'd say, so you want to deliberately not meditate so that you'll create merit instead, so you'll be able to aim your shot just right, so you'll arrive in the right country at the right time, just when Maitreya Buddha comes along. He said, "Oh yeah, that's right." Yes. And then he'd give the Northeast Thai equivalent of "good luck," or rather you than me. You know. But you know, we all have our own strange beliefs and customs. It's not as though the British are without that. And also, having been living in the United States for the last 15 years. As you can probably tell by my slightly modified English accent, I've only just arrived back in the country. But we all have our own strange beliefs and ways of looking at things. And that was what existed at the time in Ajahn Chah's world when he was a younger monk. And so it was through meeting his teacher, Ajahn Mun, Venerable Ajahn Mun. And this is the photograph of Venerable Ajahn Mun here on the right-hand side of the shrine, and Venerable Ajahn Chah on the left. And meeting Venerable Ajahn Mun and other experienced meditation masters, that Ajahn Chah learned how to practice meditation and saw for himself the immense benefits that come from that. So, but during that time, there was a very strong emphasis in Thailand on the importance of intellectual study of the teachings, and it was rare to be one who was interested in meditation. So there was often an emphasis on trying to get people to put down the books and to sit down, close the eyes, and bring the attention to the breath or to another meditation object. And so that this was a very common theme of Ajahn Chah's, and he would use the analogy of saying, it's rather, if you spend your time studying the teachings, you immerse yourself, so you become an expert in Buddhist philosophy, and you know scads and scads of the teachings, you can even recite books and books of them. So it's rather like being the ladle in the soup pot. And the soup might be extremely delicious and very rich and nourishing, but it's rather like being the ladle. The ladle doesn't know the taste of the soup. That it just sits in the pot. It's right in the soup. it's immersed in the soup, but it's not able to benefit from the nutrition that's there, or the flavor that's there, or any of those qualities from it. Or another example that he used quite memorably when he was visiting here in England, and I wasn't present myself. I was just finishing off a degree at London University when Ajahn Chah first visited here in 1977. And as I understand it, it was an exchange between the Ajahn and someone who had been a long-standing practitioner of Buddhism and a Buddhist scholar here in Britain. And this person asked a very intellectual question about the suttas, or some particular abstruse aspect of Buddhist philosophy. And it was clear to Ajahn Chah that this person was extremely sincere, but was very much fixated on the intellectual knowledge of the teachings. And he said, you know, you have to be, I appreciate your sincerity, and this is a good question in some respects, but you really have to be careful in the way that you relate to Buddhist knowledge, because, you know, if you spend all your time studying the scriptures and delving into just the intellectual aspect of it, and you make that the most important thing, it's rather like someone who spends all their time raising chickens, looking after them, taking care of them, feeding them, making sure they all have the best water supply and all the best kind of chicken run to roam around in. And then all you do is collect the chicken's droppings rather than collecting the eggs. You know, you've got all of this richness and goodness that's coming from the teachings, but you're missing the main thing of value, and you're just collecting the leftovers. And so it was, and he was, in his very friendly and charming way, sort of chiding, gently chiding this person that they could be better off steering their attention towards a more essential aspect of the teachings. So then if the Dhamma is not the words themselves, and sometimes we can instead think of the Dhamma as some kind of magical quality that's off somewhere else, and that it's very easy for us to think that there's some kind of mystical place or magical domain somewhere. And certainly when I left England, just after I'd finished that degree in 77, I decided to go out to the mystic East. Okay, I'm going to begin my journey to the East. Okay, I've done it with academia. I'm fed up with that. Had enough. Finished my degree. I'm all done there. So I'll go off on my spiritual journey. And I'd heard that Bali was a mystical island, and everything was very spiritual there. So I thought, well, I'll go to Bali and be spiritual. You know, it's a spiritual island, so I'll go there. And of course, when I get there, I'll be spiritual, right? So to my amazement, I packed up my things and said goodbye to everybody and took off on a one-way journey to the Far East, and originally flew into Kuala Lumpur, and then made my way down to Bali, and then finally, here I am, the mystical island. And to my amazement, all of my neurotic, insecure habits that I'd been hoping to leave behind in England all come with me. And so, to my amazement, here I was on the mystical, spiritual island, and all of my problems were still there too. So I remember having a bit of a head scratch, thinking, I thought I was going to leave all this behind. And then a few moments later, I thought, that was a really stupid thing to to believe. Why on earth did I think it was going to be that simple? But we can be that way. We can think that there's some kind of magical place that we can visit, that some beautiful spot in the countryside, or some place as a particular value going off to, even to say, Buddhist countries or places that have a particular serenity or beautiful natural quality. But isn't it interesting how many times we've been to that perfect place and then, darn it. So this place would be wonderful if only I wasn't here. You know, if only I hadn't brought me along too. Then this foolish mind that keeps chattering away and running, writing commentaries about everything that's going on here, or not even going on. So we can look for the Dhamma, this quality of truth or reality, this special quality. We can think it's somewhere else, or some other time, like say back in the time when, with the Buddha, with Gautama Buddha 2,500 years ago. Well, then it was really easy to see the Dhamma because you were, the Buddha was teaching it and explaining it. If we'd be able to hear the Buddha directly, then we would be able to know. Or maybe off in the future. Well, you know, we missed the last Buddha. We'll be ready for the next one. You know, but he shouldn't make fun of waiting for the Maitreya. I'm really serious about that, and I do want to be around when Maitreya Buddha comes. And so we think, well, it's off in the future. Or maybe our attention is more drawn to, well, it's there in an individual person. If you actually not just meeting a fully enlightened Buddha, but meeting an enlightened sage or a great spiritual teacher, that in meeting that person face to face, hearing their teachings face to face, then that will be when we are able to encounter the Dhamma and to know that truth, to understand that truth. And so there, certainly that's true to a certain extent. There's one of the famous, most well-known and respected teachings of the Buddha was an encounter between himself and a monk called Vakali. And Vakali was extremely ill and couldn't get up and walk about and couldn't come to visit the Buddha. And the Buddha had heard that Vakali was suffering and extremely ill, and so instead he went to go and visit him. The Buddha was living in Rajagaha, and he went out to find Vakali in his hut, in his kuti, and went to see him. And Vakali was quite distressed because he was so weak he could hardly even get up off the low bed to pay his respects to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "Please, Vakali, be at ease. Don't get upset. Just stay where you are. You don't have to bow or anything. You know, you're way too sick to get up and move. Don't worry about it." And Vakali said, "Well, I feel I would really like to pay respects to you, and it's so long since I've seen you. I felt a lot of regret and unhappiness because it's been so long since I've been able to come and see you and to visit." And then the Buddha said, "Why would you want to see this filthy body, Vakali? You know, this is just this ordinary unpleasant collection of organic parts. You know, why do you want to see this? You know, why is this so important to you?" And so then in this exchange, then Vakali expresses his devotion to the Buddha, and then and the Buddha says, "Well, I don't really mind that, you know, the body. It's not so much the physical body that's the important thing, but just being in your presence is that which is significant." And the Buddha said, "You know, Vakali, you don't really have to see me, because one who sees the Dhamma sees me. One who sees me sees the Dhamma." And that exchange between the two of them is a teaching that's quoted very, very often. And so that we can have that experience when you meet a great spiritual teacher like Lumpur Sumato, or here at Amravati, or other great teachers, that there's something, a shift that can happen within us, a transformation that can happen within us. Something of our own everyday concerns falls away, our own mundane reality and perceptions drop away for a moment, and then the mind is awakened to a more fundamental presence, a more fundamental reality. And that certainly being close to great beings can have that effect. But then similarly, if I think the teaching that the Buddha was trying to give to Vakali is to say, "Yes, you know, Vakali, I know that there is this reverence that you have, and this very positive effect that you feel when you're around me. But actually, if you see the Dhamma itself, if you see that truth, then it's as if you are face to face with the Buddha." And the partner to this teaching is one that's you find in a sutta in the Itivuttaka, which is called the hem of the robe, and the Buddha says, "If someone took hold of the edge of my robe and followed me around day after day, if that person's heart was filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, it would be as if they were far away from me, as if they were remote and distant from me. But if someone is way off in retreat in the Himalayas and they're 100 leagues away, if that person's heart is united with virtue, with concentration, with wisdom, if they practice the Eightfold Path, then it's as if they're sitting close to me, face to face. So these are interesting and useful teachings in terms of how the Buddha related to that quality of physical presence. Because what can also happen when we feel like, well, if I'm close to the teacher, then I'm close to the Dhamma, then we can end up by hanging on to the edge of the robe, following devotedly the teacher around. And maybe some of you are already booking your tickets to Thailand in November to see if you can keep track of Lumpur Sumedho as he travels. I'm not psychic, by the way, so in case any of you know, in case any of you are thinking, he knows, how did he know? He's bugging my phone. It's just human nature is the way it is. So we can end up trying to draw close to the teacher and thinking, well, if I'm close to the teacher, I'm close to the guru, then I'm close to reality, I'm close to the Dhamma. It's embodied in this person, so if I'm close to them, I'm close to the truth, I'm close to that reality. And that in the same way as looking after the chickens, you know, you can be trying so hard to get close that you don't realize that your own attitude is filled with anxiety or with an attitude of grasping or an attitude of insecurity, and we're creating a dependency on the presence of the other. So what all of these point to, these kind of places where, in a way, where the Dhamma isn't, it really points to what's left, which is that essentially the Dhamma is to be found within ourselves. And that's even though there are these external forms, like the presence of a great teacher, the thousands of pages of sutta teachings and commentaries and so forth, the wonderful effects of being in peaceful places or serene environments, or even in Bali, you know, they do have their effect. But in a way, those effects are more like a catalyst for helping us to wake up to that the inner reality, and that the Dhamma is essentially it's a quality to be recognized within ourself, and the words, the presence of the teacher, these other external forms are there to help awaken, to trigger a recognition of that inner quality. Now, there's a very substantial clue to this with when we have our daily recitation of the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. When we're describing the Buddha and the Sangha, then the words of the chanting very much reflect the external aspects of these. Like it's talking about the Buddha as the teacher, as Gautama Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago, as our mentor and exemplar and guide, and the Sangha as being those who have awakened to the various levels of enlightenment. That's what that mysterious phrase, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. It means that those who have reached the on the path to stream entry, and those who have reached stream entry on the path to being a once returner, and having reached once returner, there's four levels of enlightenment. But when you look at the reflection on Dhamma, then it's actually got a very different quality. It says the Dhamma is apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inwards, to be experienced by each wise person for themselves. So it doesn't even tangentially refer to the words of the teaching, or even the physical presence of a teacher. But it's talking about an inner quality. So these aspects of leading inwards to be realized by each wise person for themselves. So it's an inner quality. And when we try to describe that inner quality that of Dhamma or of truth, then words start to fail us. So that the Buddha tended to use fairly simple language in trying to point to the way of realizing Dhamma, but he doesn't go into enormous detail or poetic descriptions of what exactly is the Dhamma. It's more the attention goes on to the means of realizing that truth, that ultimate reality itself, is beyond words, is beyond concepts, but the concepts and the words, the forms can point to the way to realize it. But there are a few ways that it can be described in terms of what the Dhamma is. And one way that I find is helpful to reflect on it is to consider it to be the fundamental ordering principle of the universe. It's like that the Dhamma is that sort of quality which forms the patterns of the mental and the physical world, sort of the underlying ordering principle of all things. And the Buddha summarized this as a place where he says the Dhamma is dependent origination. Dependent origination is the Dhamma. And what that essentially means is the law of causality, that fundamental law of cause and effect, like this affecting that. That this is not just the kind of the idea of causality, because you might think sounds a little bit dry, a law of cause and effect. But it's not just an idea of a law, but in a way that the fundamental kind of engine of our own experience and the fabric of our being, our mind, our heart, the material world, the whole universe, the Dhamma is the fundamental forming and activating principle of the whole mental and physical realm. When that's experienced, then the experience of Dhamma, then you can describe as a quality of suchness, a quality of peacefulness. And when we use the word Nibbana, or Nirvana in Sanskrit, that's the describing the experience of the mind knowing the Dhamma without any kind of obstruction whatsoever. When the heart awakens to its own nature, when the Dhamma is truly known, the experience is that of peacefulness. The experience is that of Nibbana, of suchness. Now some reflections on the what of Dhamma, what we're looking for. So maybe that already sounds a bit too abstruse and hard to pin down. But this is the nature of the teaching, also the nature of reality. You have to also consider, after the Buddha was fully enlightened, his first thought was, there's no point trying to explain this to anybody. No one is ever going to understand this. So I'm just going to go off and be a hermit. So he thought about retirement even before he started. So it's not easy to pin down. Yeah. It's not easy to characterize. But to me, it's very important to, in a way, to get a feel for what it is that we're referring to when we reflect on the Dhamma. When we revere that quality, it's in a way bringing our hearts into accord with the actuality of our own lives, of the whole natural order. That's what we're doing. And when there is that alignment, when there is that attunement of the heart to that actuality, then it's just like if you're chanting together, it's like when all the voices come together and they're all exactly on the same pitch and the same rhythm. There's a oh. Or if you're listening to a piece of orchestral music, it's when all of the instruments come together in a glorious, harmonious form, and there's something that's beyond the individual notes that happens. That there's a kind of a liberated quality that's there that comes with the integration of all the different sounds. And so when we're realizing Dhamma, we use language like the ordering principle of the universe. It can sound a bit dry. But if you think of it in terms of what's the effect of that music on the heart when you hear a whole orchestra or a whole, a temple full of voices chanting, harmoniously. It's that singing. It's when the heart sings with that quality of attunement and accord. That, you know, that is, in a way, on a sensory level, is a representation of that quality of realizing Dhamma. When the heart is in accord with reality, there's that same kind of transcendent element. So then the where, if that's the what, or talking about it, referring to the what, then the where. So I've reflected on this. One of the reasons when we were planning out these talks for the summer, then Lumpur Samhita said, well, here are all these titles. Pick the ones that look interesting to you, and I'll just take the ones that are left over. So, which was very brave of him. But this was one that I picked because it's an area I have reflected on quite a lot. This, and just the idea of location in terms of Dhamma. Because you can say, well, the Dhamma is within, but you know, what does that really mean? So I thought I'd tell a little story that I heard. This is supposed to be a true story. This was by someone who used to be an Oxford Don, and he told me that one day somewhere in Oxford there was a tourist was walking around, an American tourist was walking around with a guidebook, and was looking very confused and was a bit flustered and sort of upset and frustrated. And she'd been obviously walking around town for quite a while, and finally she gave up and decided she'd talk to one of the locals. So she saw this professorial type, you know, with a sort of tweed jacket with the leather elbows and pipe still smoking in the top pocket, you know, and who's striding purposefully down the street. And she said, "Excuse me, sir, can you tell me exactly where is the university?" And apparently, the professorial type answered, "Madam, the university cannot be said to be anywhere. Whereness does not apply. The university only possesses metaphysical rather than actual existence." and then walked off. So she's still left holding her guidebook. And then, apparently, some other passerby, an undergrad who was passing by, heard this exchange and thought he'd translate. And so he said, well, what he meant was that Oxford University does not exist as a single campus. It's separate colleges that are dotted all around the town. And there is no physical university. The university is an idea which is agreed upon as existing by various people, but it's not located anywhere in space. You have all the separate bits that call themselves colleges, and they can group together and they can organize exams and give degrees, but the university cannot be said, the university, quote-unquote, cannot be said to be anywhere. Whereness does not apply. So that's how he gave the... Apparent, I guess that means it has metaphysical existence. It's beyond the physical world. Yes, it exists, but not physically. But it doesn't actually exist. So anyway, I like that story. It seems extremely credible to me. So it relates to the Dhamma in terms of the quality of awareness, because we can take our own lives or our own experience of this moment. We say, well, here we are, we're in the temple at Amaravati, that's where we are. And we take these such an idea or an experience as very in a very matter-of-fact way. It seems quite normal. But then we can also recognize that, well, in another sense, the temple of Amaravati is in our minds, right? can say we are in the temple, but also, like, if I close my eyes, the temple vanishes. I open them, then here it is again. That we put together the experience of this place. It's woven together through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and yet all of those experiences are known through the agency of our mind. I'm not saying that this is the temple is a complete invention of my mind, but for all of us here, everything that we know about this moment is known through the agency of our mind, isn't it? Right? It's woven together through what we hear, what we see, what we feel, and it all happens within the mind. We open our eyes and we say, well, no, the temple's all around us. But that, the sight of the building, the sound of my voice, the feeling of your weight on the cushion or on the chair, those are all sensory experiences woven together through our mind. And so all that we know about the world is happening within our mind. Now when we reflect on this, we don't often think in terms of that feeling of being here or being located in a particular place as being an obstruction. You might think, well, this is getting really obscure now. We might not think of that as being a hindrance to our freedom. But just as when we start to explore Buddhist meditation, we begin to look at the feeling of self, and the feelings of time that we can feel, like I am so many years old, I can remember the past, I can think, I can imagine the future. I have a feeling of individuality, a feeling of self. But when we start to look at the mind and how the mind works, and particularly the patterns of self-creation, how we think about ourselves and our memories, our expectations, our opinions about ourselves, then it's very, very easy to see how that often, along with the feeling of I and me and mine, there's a sense of tension or alienation, a sense of burden that goes along with that. So a lot of Buddhist meditation is geared towards learning to see the relative nature of the feeling of self. So probably any of you who've read much of Buddhist teachings or been around these teachings for some years, we're very familiar with the teachings about not self. And in terms of developing insight meditation, the Buddha pointed to the experience of seeing that all things that pass through consciousness, every aspect of the mental world, possesses three characteristics. One, they change. Anicca. Two, they're unsatisfactory. That means that no single experience can be permanently pleasing. Nothing can be pleasant or gratifying permanently. We can't stay perpetually pleased or content with any one thing, because things change. So things are fundamentally unsatisfactory in that way. And then thirdly, all things cannot be said to be a self or to belong to a self. That we experience, our thoughts and feelings and memories, the sensations of the body, the more that these are looked at closely, the more it can be seen that these are not truly who and what we are. There's an experience of a feeling, of a thought, of a memory, even a memory that's extremely personal, only known to us as an individual. And it might have a feeling of I-ness and me-ness and my-ness gathered around it. But when there's a close looking at that, we see, well, that's just a coloration of it. That's just a patterning of it. And that in and of itself, it's just a pattern of nature. It's just a form coming into being, doing its thing, arising, passing away. It isn't fundamentally who and what we are. A memory arises, takes its shape, does its thing, and then fades away, just like the sound of an individual word or a bird song or the sound of a child or a sensation in the body. They are patterns of nature that come into being, do their thing and pass away. So these are familiar and common areas of investigation. that we experience the patterns of mind. And that when we develop insight meditation, what we're doing is loosening up the habits of self-view, the way that the mind is confined in identification with our thoughts, our moods, our emotions. When we begin to see that, oh, it's just a thought, it's not me and mine, we find that it has a whole different texture to it. It's much less of a burden upon us, or a memory, or a responsibility. Once we see these are not, we don't take them personally. They come into being, they do their thing, they fade away. There's a lightness in the heart, there's an ease with which we experience things. There's an openness and a peacefulness that we experience when there's a letting go of the habits of self-creation, letting go of self, and letting go of time, letting go of the past and future. Now, one of the things that we don't notice is that along with that feeling of time and of self, we also continually create the experience, and that we sort of, our senses encourage us to think in terms of the past and the present, the future, and we make time into a solid thing, or we make the self into a solid thing, and then we bring the insight meditation to bear on that and examine that. We see, oh, it's really, there is only the present. The time is actually somewhat illusory, that what we always experience is this present moment. You know, the past is a memory, the future is an idea. But they are all experienced now. And then when we look at the feeling of self, we realize, okay, well, that's called, you know, my feeling. But there isn't really a me and a mindness that's anything solid or real. It's just another pattern of nature known here within this sphere of awareness. That's all. But what we can miss is that there's all of these things, all these patterns of experience are all felt or all taken to be experienced here, right? It all seems to be happening in this mind, in this place. And again, this might not seem like a big issue in your or kind of cluttering up your days. But I found that a number of years ago, when I was on a long retreat at the monastery, Abhayagiri Monastery in California, it was sort of way in the midst of the winter retreat, and things were very, very quiet. And I was using these reflections on not self and looking very, very closely at all of the flow of feelings and moods and such like. And it was really, really clear to me that, well, none of this is who and what I am. There was a great sense of transparency around the feeling of self. But there was also, along with that, despite it seemed like there was no time, there was no self at that moment, there was still this feeling of tension or burden. I thought, this is really strange. Because I'm kind of got the whole list covered here. I can see all the anicca, dukkha, anatta, unsatisfactory, impermanent, not self. So what's this feeling of burden or tension or confinement? And then it suddenly struck me, oh, I know what it is. This is all happening here. There's this feeling of here-ness, that this experience is located at this spot where, you know, where my mind is, quote unquote. And so I started to investigate that. And this was one of the reasons why when this title was suggested, I thought I'd like to explore this, because I found this was such a rich area for myself. Because when I started to look at that feeling of here-ness, that life is happening here, and that I began to see that just like the feeling of self or the feeling of time, it's an ordinary, matter-of-fact, everyday reality that is saying, like, well, of course we're here. Where else are we? We're not still in Hemel. we're not in London. Of course we're here. Just like, well, of course I'm a person. What else am I? I'm not a giraffe. Of course everything changes. Of course time is real. It's Sunday today. Otherwise we wouldn't all have come here, right? That'd be ridiculous. So like all of these aspects on a conventional level, that these are matter-of-fact realities. But I tend to call them matter-of-fiction realities. just occurs to me. It's more of a matter of fiction realities, because to call today Sunday is a human agreement. On the lunar calendar, this is not an observance day. This is not the lunar Sunday. That will be next Wednesday, I think. It'll be the half moon. It's an agreed upon convention, right? We call it Sunday because we have the convention of a 7-day week. A few centuries ago, a few thousand years ago, the 7-day week didn't exist. We went by the moon. So the agreement of calling this a Sunday is a human convention. So the conventions of time, the conventions of self, have also along with them the conventions of place. And so when we look at this in the meditation and start to explore it, then we can find a quality of freedom, a quality of contentment that we can miss in the flow of feeling that we're sort of doing all the right things or doing all the needful. Well, there's when I started to look at this, I remember there was a particular statement that Ajahn Mahabua made, which was he's one of the great enlightened masters of Thailand and highly regarded, widely recognized as being a fully enlightened being. And he described in his own description of his enlightenment experience just after the passing away of his teacher Ajahn Mun. He was after Venerable Ajahn Mun's funeral, and Ajahn Mahabua was offered a small branch monastery, and he was practicing walking meditation. And he said that as he was walking, there came to this insight came to him that he said it was almost like hearing it more than thinking it. And the way he phrased it was, "If there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is the essence of a level of being." And so I just had remembered that when I started thinking about it, or I was struck by this feeling of here-ness. Oh yeah, that's exactly what Ajahn Mahabua was talking about. If there is a point or a center of the knower, if we think that the knowing or the focus of experience is here at this spot, he says that's where the self gets born. In a way, that's like the genesis of the I feeling comes from that the shrinking or the gathering of experience to a here-ness. So that got my attention. I thought, well, this feels like it's really worth investigating. And then following that, and I remembered also there's particular teachings from the Udana, which many of you who have been coming along to Lumpur Sumedho's talks and listening to him recently will know that these are passages that he's extremely fond of. The verses on the or teachings on the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, and so I was also reminded of this particular teaching. So this is the Buddha talking about ultimate reality, the unconditioned reality. "There is that sphere where there is no earth, no water, no fire, nor wind, no sphere of infinity of space, infinity of consciousness, of nothingness, or even neither perception nor non-perception. There is neither this world nor the other world, neither moon nor sun. This sphere I call neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still, neither a dying nor a reappearance. It has no basis, no evolution, and no support. This, just this, is the end of dukkha." Now again, that might seem a bit abstruse, or not even very attractive. No sun, no moon, no stars. Ah. You know, I don't want to go there. But it's important to recognize when the Buddha says this, just this, is the end of suffering. This is the end of dukkha. That should get our attention. And so what he's saying there, and I think particularly the phrase that struck me is, "This sphere I call neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still, neither a dying nor a reappearance." Neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still. And that And so what it was pointing to me is this quality of Dhamma. When we realize the Dhamma, there needs to be a letting go of the feeling of place, the feeling of all kinds of location. And then I was also reminded of the final teaching that Lumpur Cha gave to Ajahn Sumedho way back in 1981. So that, you hear so many teachings, so many Dhamma talks, and read so many Dhamma books, and then somehow it's all parked away back in the archives, and then 20, 30 years later it becomes relevant, and it all sort of pops up again. So then I remembered, oh yeah, there was the final message that Lumpur Cha gave to Ajahn Sumedho. That was really pertinent to this theme. And this was back in 1981, before Amaravati existed. And we were living at Chidhurst Monastery, and a letter came from Thailand, and it was written in the hand of one of the Western monks. And it was addressed to Ajahn Sumedho, and he said, the letter began, "Well, Tanajan, you're not going to believe this, but Lumpur Cha asked me to take dictation, because he wanted to write you a letter. So, but here it is, and this is what he wanted me to write." And he said, "Whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building paramita, in spiritual virtues. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This, Sumedho, is your place of non-abiding." That was it. So that was really Ajahn Chah's final message to Ajahn Sumedho, because shortly after that he had the stroke and he was no longer able to. Over the next few months, his health degenerated a lot, and then by the time Ajahn Sumedho went back to visit again, he couldn't speak or walk, and that was really their final communication. So you think if Ajahn Chah was intuited that his health was collapsing and that this was going to be his last chance to send any advice to his trusted disciples starting up a new monastery overseas, you think, well, Sumedho, you should do this and don't do that, and I want you to set things up in this way and don't do that. You know, you have a lot of, to me, I would tend to go towards a list of instructions, you know, lots of do's and don'ts. You must always do this, Sumedho, and you know, this and this and this, you can change if you want to, but you absolutely mustn't change that. But there wasn't any of that. Yeah. So if you think of this in terms of Lumpur Cha's final instructions, okay, the last piece of advice he's going to be able to give. And what he chooses to say is, "The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This Sumedho is your place of non-abiding." So, what that says to me, and how it relates to this exploration of where is the Dhamma, is as soon as we try and find the Dhamma or the right thing, you know, looking for the right thing or what's true, what's real, as soon as we look for that in a plan, in things progressing, or we think it's what's happening is it's all falling apart, or even that everything is absolutely stable. That's all moving forwards, moving backwards, standing still. And that, you know, the reality of things is not to be found in whether things are progressing, whether things are falling apart, or whether they're perfectly stable. Whether things are going forward, going backwards, or standing still. That's not where the reality is. And it's only through letting go of forming our judgments in terms of things improving, things degenerating, us going somewhere, us going nowhere, or us being stuck or being stationary. It's a matter of letting go of defining how things are or what the right thing is in terms of those ordinary everyday categories. When we let go of that, because it's a very strong urge, certainly for myself, you know, my mind is very much prone to wanting to have a plan or figuring things out. You know, I love to take refuge in explanation or a list. You know, if I've got a list, then everything's all right with the world. As long as I can, as long as I got my list, then I'm okay. But what this is pointing to is that the only thing to trust, where we're really going to find the Dhamma, is in that place of non-abiding, of their readiness to let go of defining where we are or what the right thing is, defining that sort of place of being. Does that make sense? It's not an easy quality to explain or to exemplify, but it's a very key aspect of meditation practice. So if we're wanting to develop wisdom, develop the quality of insight, and using insight meditation, then what I found is using these reflections on location or non-locality, on non-abiding, learning to see how we tend to lock our attention onto the feeling of everything's happening here or the experience of things happening here, or wanting to define who and what we are by a particular activity or where things are going or how things are progressing. It takes a careful attention to that, to see, oh yeah, my mind is trying to find an abiding place in a plan or in an explanation or a description, trying to pin things down. And then we see that effort happening within us, and we respond by loosening up, by letting go and allowing that quality of non-abiding, of letting the Dhamma be unlocated, letting go of that sense of here-ness, then it's very frustrating and disturbing to the ego, but very liberating to the heart. Because in terms of ego and self, we love to have things defined and clear, even though it might be a fiction. We prefer our familiar fictions to the unfamiliar, unconditioned and unformed, the unlocated. But if what we really value is the quality of freedom, then there needs to be a recognition of that. So out of this, and when during that retreat, and one practice I'd like to suggest, if for those of you who are interested in Buddhist meditation or have done some Buddhist meditation, is with insight meditation practice, when the mind is brought to a quality of calm or steadiness, a quality of focus, and then the mind rests easily in the present moment, along with the reflections on, because generally speaking, what we'd use would be the reflections on change, like to recognize, oh, this is changing, this sound is arising and ceasing, or this thought is arising and ceasing. On unsatisfactoriness, this feeling is dukkha, this memory is dukkha, this is unsatisfactory, it can't be totally and permanently pleasing in and of itself. Or that it's not self, this memory is not who and what I am, it arises, it ceases. It's not a self or doesn't belong to a self. This feeling of I, even our own name is just another formation, nature that's not truly who and what we are. So along with those reflections on impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and not self, we use develop the reflection on non-locality. And what I used in that retreat time was mostly the question, just I would bring up the question, where is here? Where is here? Or just even, not even using a question, just to use the word here-ness. And through bringing that attention to the feeling the mind trying to be located, then that would be like bringing the spotlight, like you got the sunlight coming in and spotlighting a few other people. It's like that feeling, that presumption of location would be spotlighted, and then the wisdom faculty of the heart recognizes, oh, where doesn't really apply. That's a presumption. It's not anywhere. The truth is not anywhere. This awareness is not anywhere. So in answer to the question, where is the Dhamma? You can't really say, to say it's everywhere is not quite right. And to say it's nowhere is not quite right. But I also, when I was reflecting on this, I came up with the neologism of not where. The Dhamma is not where. that it's awareness does not apply, and when there's a letting go of that quality of fixity, of location, then just like I'm not going to guarantee total enlightenment like Ajahn Mahabua. But it's to me that was interesting, that very insight was what presaged his complete liberation. That if there is a center or a point for the knower, then that is the essence of a level of being. When that when the knowing is not focused around a center, when that knowing is allowed to be non-located, then there's a freedom from birth. It's like the sense of self is not seeded, and that there's awareness, the mind is fully awake and open, but there's a quality of freedom and a lack of confinement and an ease, a peacefulness that is very hard to find. If that the quality of awareness is still unconsciously being fixed, being grasped, and being identified with a particular focus. And maybe the last thing to say is that in terms of where is the Dhamma, that might all sound, I realize I'm in danger of sounding extremely abstruse with all of this, but I do find it's a very helpful tool in developing insight practice. And another of the sequences Ajahn Chah used to use, or another of the forms of the teaching that he used to use a lot, was he would say that in terms of developing the practice, it starts off with us hearing the Dhamma. We hear the Dhamma, then we practice the Dhamma. Having practiced the Dhamma, we know it. So we hear it, we practice it, we know it. We know the Dhamma. And then with that knowing, from going from an intellectual knowing to a direct realization, then the final stage of that whole sequence is that of being Dhamma. That it's that's the progression that develops. And so and he would often talk in these terms that the point is not just to understand the Dhamma or to know it intellectually, but to be Dhamma, to realize this is what we are. Everything that we are is Dhamma. As he would also say, inside is Dhamma, outside is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma. And so that when we develop this practice to the full, then we realize that's what we are, that's all that we are, and that's all we ever have been. It's just that we missed it because we thought we were this personality, or this body, or this nationality, this age. We didn't realize, oh, this is all Dhamma. Inside is Dhamma, outside is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this afternoon. Please take what is useful, and what is not, please leave aside. So now it's time for tea, I believe, and I think the retreat center kitchen and that area is all set up for the tea time, so please go and help yourselves there. And then it's just after 3 o'clock now, so how long is the tea time usually? 20 minutes? So that can be for 20 minutes, and then we can gather back here, and if people have any questions or things you'd like to ask or things that need clarification and so forth, then please feel free to come back, and we'll carry on with the time for dialogue later on.